From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barbara Ehrenreich has a thing for American workers. Her book, Nickel and Dimed, had her waiting tables and scrubbing toilets to illuminate the life of the blue-collar working class. This time, she's putting on a sensible suit and taking up the cold sweat challenge of landing a job these days in white-collar America. In her new book, Bait and Switch, Barbara's networking, cruising job fairs, working with image consultants, posting her resume on Monster.com. For days, weeks, months, what she finds on her road to nowhere is not a job, but a desperate realm of formerly employed folks who were tossed out of the corporate castle and cannot find their way back in. Well-educated, hard-working, experienced Americans losing their grip on middle-class status and the American dream. We're talking about white-collar blues this hour with Barbara Ehrenreich. You can join the conversation. Have you fallen out of the white-collar nest and had to fight your way back in? What was it like for you? Was it a snap, or do you know how cold the wind can blow out there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be joined in just a moment by Barbara Ehrenreich, but I want to begin this hour with a check-in on the economy and employment post-Katrina with David Wessel, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. David, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
We hear you on Morning Edition all the time. You're the voice of American economic analysis these days. What does it look like post-Katrina?
Well, you know, immediately after Katrina, it looked very scary because oil prices went up so far so fast. Oil is the lifeblood of the American economy, and it was a little bit like the economy had a heart attack, and the circulatory system, the pipelines, the refineries were impaired as well.
Yeah.
Since Katrina, though, the markets are telling us that they don't think the worst case has come true. Oil prices have come down a bit. Even the futures price of gasoline, whereas where the financial markets bet on where gasoline prices are, have come down some. So what that tells us is this is obviously bad for the economy. The economy will grow slower as a result. There will be more unemployment. The pain will be particularly bad in the affected states. But the national economy as a whole at the moment looks pretty resilient, and it looks like it won't be a long-lived, terrifying downturn.
And what about job creation, David? Describe the trend for us in recent months and the projections now.
Well, right now, the economy has been growing at a reasonably healthy pace, and economists expect it to grow at about 3.5% annual rate for the rest of the year. Basically, that means they'll continue to be hiring, but the unemployment rate won't come down. We are seeing a period of time, and I think what Barbara Ehrenreich is going to talk about, where there's just enormous turmoil in the labor market. And beneath those totals, there's a whole lot going on. There's a whole lot of people who are being dislocated. There's a whole lot of people who are finding it very, very, very hard to get raises, if at all. And there's other pockets of the labor market where demand for workers seems to be extraordinarily strong. Their wages are going up. So we see a lot of turmoil and a lot of widening of the gap between the winners and the losers.
Is it possible to generalize about the quality of jobs that are available, particularly that kind of middle-tier, white-collar job that Barbara Ehrenreich's writing about?
I think it's very hard to generalize about the quality of the jobs. We have 133 million jobs in the U.S., and they're not all bad jobs. Not everybody is struggling to get by on their wages, and not everybody is at risk of being laid off tomorrow. I think we know that the labor market is much more competitive now than it ever was before, that companies have much less loyalty to their employees. There are many fewer workers who have union protections, and workers in many industries have much less loyalty to their employers and are much quicker to jump when a new company starts for a chance to get in at the bottom. We do also know that even though life has been even though the economy has not been kind to a lot of college graduates, young college graduates fared particularly badly in the couple of years after 9/11, you are much better off being an educated worker than a not educated worker.
You wrote recently, David, about a middle tier in the globalization game, not the winners whose companies do great one way or another off globalization, and not the clear losers, textile factory workers and others whose jobs go directly overseas, but the middle tier, which sounded to me like a middle class, middle tier, white collar crew, who were in an odd way losers in globalization, or at least left in that turmoil you talked about earlier.
Well, I call them tweeners, and I don't think they're all white-collar workers. There are a lot of white-collar workers for whom trade is only a plus.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do they get to buy cheap close at Walmart, but their companies are doing well in the global economy. But I think there are a lot of people for who the gains from trade are relatively small and hard to put your finger on. And the risk that globalization creates, the risk that you'll get out, your job will get outsourced, or that your company will be taken over by a foreign company, or your company's strategy will be destroyed by a more nimble foreign competitor, are very great. And so for those people, I think it's really important to say, look, they're not irrational to say this trade sounds good in principle, but for me it's just making my economic life much riskier. And there I think there's a real imperative for those people who believe that globalization is basically good to figure out a way how to arm these people to compete better in the global economy.
David Wessel, finally, bottom line for those middle-class white-collar workers, is job security as Americans knew it or think they knew it coming back in their lifetimes?
Probably not. The economy changes very fast. Globalization has and technology together have picked up the speed of change, and companies will respond by moving much more quickly, and a lot of times the workers get hurt in that process.
David Wessel, great speaking with you as always. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Wessel, The Wall Street Journal's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief. Joining me now is Barbara Ehrenreich. Her new book is Bait and Switch. Barbara, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, Jack.
All right. Barbara Ehrenreich, last time out you were cleaning toilets and working at Walmart and serving up chain food servings. Now you're stepping into this middle-class job search maelstrom, and you are clearly a duck out of water here. I have to say, you seem somehow more comfortable with a mop than looking for a white-collar job.
I think you're right, Tom. I actually
I don't mean that. I mean
research.
No. I mean no disrespect by that. Just an observation.
No, you're right. I know what kind of job I'm suited for. I face it. I'm better off cleaning floors and stuff, and serving food. I realize that now. But you know, there's a connection between the two books. The reason I went into this bait and switch white collar job search life is that as a result of Nickel and Dimed, I've gotten lots and lots of letters from people in really bad situations, mm-hmm. you know, like facing eviction or having a serious illness diagnosed but no health insurance. Mm. And a lot of these people writing have college degrees, even master's degrees, and had once had what they thought were secure white-collar jobs.
Which raised your awareness of a world beyond the blue-collar world where there was a lot of insecurity, and you set up a very particular challenge for yourself with your own kind of game rules. Barbara Ehrenreich, I wish you'd lay out for us, once you spotted this as an area of interest, what was the game that you laid out?
Well, I decided to investigate the way I had with Nickel and Dime, that is, by actually putting myself physically into the situation. So I went undercover, really undercover this time, with a fake name, a changed name, and a fake resume.
Yeah.
And went out there as a job seeker. My rules were I had to do everything possible, take any form of help I could find to get a job. And I hoped initially that I would get one, and then I would, you know, see things really from the inside, mm-hmm. and I would do my best at it. In fact, there was nothing in my resume, fake as it was, that I couldn't do.
You actually wanted to get inside what you call the corporate castle and work at a job there for a while and see what that was like as well. You never made it across the moat.
Well, Tom, that's a little unfair. You know, I was offered something toward the end. I don't know if I should give away the
sure,
the
why not? Aflac came out and offered you a job as a sales rep for Aflac. We'll talk about that. But you really got stymied before you could even get inside despite your best efforts.
Well, for one thing, it's very confusing. What do you do? Some advice is that you focus all your time on the internet job boards, mm-hmm. you know, monster.com, and mm-hmm. then there are a slew of more specialized ones. And that you just pore over those for hours every day and constantly tweak your resume and hoping it'll rise to the top of the virtual pile if there's some little change in it. So that's one kind of advice. And the other kind of advice is, no, that's useless. Spend all your time, quote, networking. Mm-hmm. That is going out there, you know, appropriately suited up and meeting people, handing out business cards, and trying, you know, to make an impression on someone. But then where do you do this networking? How do you find the decision makers to make an impression on? So there's a lot of things that don't make sense. And a lot of the networking events you go to turn out not to really be an opportunity to meet and greet others, but some kind of lecture or New Agey mind games.
That is a kind of industry in itself, waiting to squeeze a few dollars from you as you desperately look for a job. Jack Beatty, you dipped into this book and found Barbara Ehrenreich putting on that suit, trying to be appropriately attentive and compliant to everyone she met, and just not getting anywhere.
Just not getting anywhere. I mean, Barbara, you take us here on a tour of a middle class in transition, from economic insecurity to economic insecurity, and from confidence to self-doubt, from platform jobs, you know, that can support a life, to survival jobs that define life down. And, you know, it's this purgatorial state of the transition from one job to another. And what's the ticket out of that purgatory? Personality. Show personality. Well, what's the one thing people who are unemployed can't show because they're so depressed and feel so insecure? Personality. And then the other ticket? Oh, your elevator speech. But no one wants to hear your elevator speech. Your two-liner about why you're the best worker in the world. No one will listen.
Barbara Ehrenreich out there, right. Not cleaning toilets this time, but not getting a white-collar job either. We're talking about white-collar blues. Her new book is Bait and Switch. You can join us. Have you fallen out of the white-collar nest and had to fight your way back in? How did it go? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about white-collar blues with Barbara Ehrenreich. She's author of Nickel and Dimed, her last book out this time. The book is Bait and Switch, the parens futile unparens pursuit of the American dream. You can join the conversation. Have you felt the chill wind that can blow Americans right out of the middle class? Is it as bad as Barbara Ehrenreich portrays? And have you felt the fear of falling and not getting up in the white-collar job world? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barbara, over the last few years, we've certainly talked with people who have gone through this, and they will be listening very carefully to your story, gauging against their own very personal circumstances. I think we better lay out just a little more about you, where you came from, your sort of background and attitudes, so people can judge your effort here. You're a lifelong writer. You're a social activist. You have next to no experience in the corporate world, quote unquote. So where were you coming from, and what were you looking for?
Well, I'm a journalist, and this is a, you know, respectable form of journalism. Mm-hmm. It's called immersion journalism, mm-hmm. where you put yourself right out there in the situation. That's what I was trying to do. I had to set aside a lot of my background, you know, and which has been very critical of corporations for any number of reasons. Like, I've been very critical over the years of pharmaceutical corporations, mm-hmm. and yet that's what I focused on getting a job with. It was one of my focuses because, you know, I know something about them and their problems, and since I was representing myself as a PR person.
So public relations was the job you wanted, and because you knew about pharmaceuticals, you that was your top target.
I kind of focused on them, ultimately. Though I was – you'd look at anything. I mean, really, modular building, construction, you name it. I was, you know, willing to entertain any idea at all. I'm not saying I'm a perfect test case for the job market. Mm-hmm. I'm a little over the hill. You know, you shouldn't really be over 45. And
shame on you. What were you thinking getting older
I'm
like that?
Sorry about that. And I think that in itself is something that's a whole other subject that could be discussed, because people don't just, all die when they're 45 or stop eating.
But it's a lot of people over 45 who, in the turmoil in the job market that David Wessel with the Wall Street Journal described earlier, these are a lot of the people who are out there looking for the next job.
Yeah. I mean, the turmoil may mean that you bounce back a number of times, but then when you get to be about over 45, then you may not ever get back in.
Barbara, take us through, if you would, walk us through the stages of your search. You threw yourself out there. You said, okay, here I am, America. I want a job in the corporate world. You put together a resume, put your some phony stuff in it, but it looked reasonable, or you so you hoped and thought. You took on your maiden name so you were not known. And what did you find? What were the sort of, I have to say, circles of hell you went through as you looked for a job?
Well, first I was looking for help. So I hired career coaches. One didn't last very long. He was the one who liked to illustrate his little lessons with Wizard of Oz dolls.
Now and you're Dorothy. Now you're the Tin Man. Off you go.
Well, this all had something to do with personality, understanding your personality. He gave me a personality test where it turned out that I am good and loving, mm-hmm. but also envious and melancholy. And for some reason, the bottom line of this was I am very ill-suited to be a writer. That's something I probably couldn't
That would never
do,
work.
Said.
But he put you on the couch first for a kind of
psychoanalysis.
Yeah,
they all want to do that. They all want to talk about your personality. I thought, well, wait a minute. What does that – I've told you what I do. It's PR. So what if my personality is more suited to being an embalmer? You know, it's a little late for that now.
Okay.
And I just thought, this, what is this personality stuff? I couldn't comprehend it. Then I had some other coaches, these coaches, the more useful ones, really worked on getting that resume, really eye-catching and spiffy.
And how did they suggest you do that to make that drop-dead desirable resume?
I should charge you for giving you advice on that. A career coach would charge you $200 an hour for this advice. I'm not going to just give it away, Tom.
Well, come on. Give us a couple of freebies here.
Well, there are different schools of thought, chronology versus function. But a lot depends on format. You've got to have that bolding. You've got to have those bullets. And you should have some key words. Now, you don't know really what they are, but most companies aren't going to have human beings reading resumes that are on the job boards and the internet. They're going to just scan them with a computer program that looks for the key words.
Give us one. What was the magic word?
Well, I read that last month, I think one of the key words was strategic.
Okay.
Now, I didn't have that in my resume. Who knew?
Maybe that was
I would
the problem.
Go back and sprinkle that in my resume.
But it's amazing how much time you can spend just struggling to get the language hip and current and right in a resume. And then with that in hand, you head out into the kind of inspirational lecture/networking world. Who did you find when you got there? On the dais and around you in the audience, Barbara Ehrenreich?
Well, you find a lot of people who seem to me quite depressed. These are the fellow job seekers. And also, to my surprise, you find in these settings, and there are a lot of group settings now for white-collar folks to go to, people who do have jobs but either hate those jobs because they're too stressed out, they cannot work 14 hours a day anymore. See, as companies downsize ever more, that means mm-hmm. the survivors left behind roughing doing the work of two. And they want to get out. And then you find people who are employed right now, but they hear the drumbeats of layoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, people who are kind of messed up in their lives right now and feeling very down. And then you usually have a kind of inspirational lecture. You don't really get to network with these other people, which, if I could summarize the themes, mm-hmm. it often seemed to me a lot of victim blaming. You hear over and over, and you get it in the business advice books too, that everything depends on your attitude. You can change the universe, in fact, with your thoughts, if your thoughts are positive and focused enough mm-hmm. when you beam them out there.
Mm-hmm.
So that means, if you lost a job, maybe you had the wrong attitude. Maybe you weren't, quote, likable enough. That's another big word, being likable. So you've got to work on yourself. You can't think about the economy. You can't think about corporate policies or anything like that. You just got to focus on looking inward.
Which makes it all very personal. Jack Beattie, I know you were reading along here as well. There were some pretty miserable crowds that Barbara Ehrenreich was hanging out with as she tried to work her way out of unemployment or out of transition, as it's called these days.
Yes, and people had to go through these rituals of degradation where they would stand up in front of the group and start to tell their story, and the moderator would say, freeze, and then intervene with his rap. And it was always, as you say, Barbara, this sort of solipsistic snake oil. you know, you are to blame. You're the universe. If you're laid off, it isn't because the market is down. It's some failure in you. And by the way, if you come after the lecture, I'll be able to do some therapy on that particular problem you have. I mean, it's part of their rap.
And that'll cost you, my friend, that extra.
Yes,
that
that's
extra.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But Barbara, Ehrenreich, here's a question that kept coming up to me throughout this. I mean, you were doing immersion journalism, as you describe it. You set up a kind of a challenge for yourself, but it wasn't the real deal. You were writing a book, and that book would go out and be sold, and that was your meal ticket. So was your failure here because you weren't really hungry? You're a skeptic. Or even more than that, you're kind of almost an alien, an infidel here. I mean, you're a lifelong critic of corporate America, kind of balky and, skeptical all the time. Talk about not being in the game. Were you having trouble because you were so far out of it?
Well, I think in one practical way, perhaps, because if I had been a veteran of the corporate world, I think I would have had corporate contacts that, you know, in my Rolodex, people I could have called and said, you know, hi, Jim, here I am, you know of anything. I didn't, and that would have been a drawback. But I think my attitude was, hey, pretty good, you know? In fact, I did things that kind of surprised me. That I kind of got into the mode of, I got to sell myself. That very phrase, you know, gives me the creeps in normal life because I can't separate myself into, you know, some commodity that I'm going to go out and sell. But I really tried to get into that and pushed it. Even found myself when I was among some PR people I was networking with proposing ethically challenged solutions to PR problems just because I was enjoying being kind of, you know, smart and showing off.
But maybe you presumed too much about what you were entitled to or what you would have. I mean, in the real world, if someone met as much failure as you did in the search for a white-collar job, they might just turn around and try anything to make an income.
Do. But you have to remember that 44% of the long-term unemployed in this country now are white-collar people. And I think that's a historical high. So that, you know, searching for 10 months as I did is nothing unusual. But of course, at some point, and I was really at that point, people say, well, you know, I've sold my house or I've moved in back in with my parents. I've auctioned my possessions off on eBay. Now I've got to take any job at all. And that's when, you know, they go down to Best Buy or whatever it is and get a job. But maybe $8 an hour. And that can really be the end of their white-collar life because, well, you can't – Best Buy or Walmart aren't going to give you time off to go to interviews.
And then you're
in
trouble.
And you can't put that in your resume.
Right.
You know?
Lord, no.
A gap in your resume, you're sunk.
Jack Beattie, what do you think here? A fair test with Barbara Ehrenreich? She put a lot of effort into making herself a test case, but then – maybe she's supposed to be an outsider, a writer, a teacher of college seminars, an activist. Maybe that corporate castle just isn't her domain.
Maybe, but I was struck that 11 of the people whom you met on your travels, Barbara, at the end of 10 months or some such period of time, they hadn't found jobs either. And several of them had fallen into, well, one guy was a chauffeur, another woman worked at not a Walmart, but Best Buy or something, and they were sinking down into these what you call survival jobs. In other words, they were kind of controls on you, is what I thought. That these folks who had been in the world, who'd had experience, were now in this limbo.
Was it that bad for the folks around you, Barbara?
Oh yes, yeah, and you know it's that's why I say this book is really about poverty and different ways you can get into it, even if you've, quote, done everything right in your life, like getting a college degree. There are a lot of catch-22s, too, that really astonish me. Like, you are likely to ruin your credit rating or at least damage it a little bit when you're unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you won't have health insurance, so you're probably going to have some medical bills. Well, 37% of companies, and the number is growing rapidly, want a perfect credit rating as a condition for hiring.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this thing which just seems to me the biggest catch-22 is that the longer you're unemployed, the less likely you are to get a job.
Because you're
you'll
stale.
Have this gap.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. on your resume.
We've got a lot of people who have been around this track who want to speak with you, Barbara Ehrenreich. Just a mountain of callers here waiting. If I may, I'd like to turn to them. Chris is calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've been unemployed for 4.5 years now. Mm-hmm. I have a college degree. I have experience in media. I want to stay in media, but stay in Boston. And I feel like at my age, which is 35, I'm now too old to be employed, that a lot of college students getting out of school now are more marketable because they have no experience and they don't need as much money for a salary as I do. And
over the hill at 35, you're saying, Chris?
Yep.
Your experience ought to count for something. It ought to make
It should count for something, but I can't even get an internship.
So what are you concluding from this? Do you think...
I don't know what to conclude. I feel utterly hopeless, and I'm frightened, and I've done everything she has mentioned in her book.
The networking and all the rest.
Oh, I've been to so many networking events. It's very difficult to spin your unemployment. I mean, I have temped at a major university that's put some food on my table for a long time.
And what are your finances like now?
My finances, I'm probably going to be evicted in about 3 weeks. I will probably have to move back home. My insurance, health insurance, is $400, going to be up to $500 a month. I'm just, the only reason I am not living on the streets is because of my mother.
Are you too picky, Chris? Maybe you can't stay in Boston.
Also seen people who are just as picky get jobs, so then that's when I hit the career advisors.
Barbara, give a quick counseling session to Chris here. What do you say?
Well, I'm sort of stunned because, the idea of 35 being too old is very scary. But I think, you're right, Chris, because there's, we talk a lot about outsourcing to other countries. The other thing is this, get rid of the person who's 35 or 45, replace them by a 22-year-old who can work twice as hard. And what's kind of very disturbing to me about that is that, what about experience? Why just throw away people's experience? It's like the sociologist Richard Sennett has written a book about this, and he says, we have a culture now that does not value experience. It tosses it away.
How can that be? What's your interpretation of that? Because the internet makes everything instantly knowable, so you don't have to come in knowing anything?
No, the internet does not substitute for experience. But, it's like all this, in a way, to me, this crazy insistence on networking. Think about it. That's a way of saying it doesn't matter who you are and what you can do. It matters who you know. And that led to, things like Michael Brown being the head of FEMA.
But I thought there was another interpretation of that, which was just that you needed to get out there and let a lot of people know that here are my talents and I'm available and I'm personable and you can hire me. That's not exactly cronyism. That's just trying to, get out in the market, the job market, isn't it?
Yeah, but if it worked that way, Tom, you'd be able to, you'd get a job by posting your resume on the job boards. That would say that here's my experience, here I am, what do you think?
And it's just not that simple. Chris, we wish you luck, and I'm not sure what the advice is here, but we're rooting for you. Thanks for calling. Jack, here it is again. Chris calls and says 4.5 years, and she can't find a job. On the other hand, during that time, I can well imagine a Bush economist saying, we have created millions of jobs in those years. There should be one for you in there, Chris.
Yes, it may be that she has middle-class expectations, and the job market, at least here, won't yield them. And that's the part of this book that really depressed me, that people are having to kind of edit their expectations. Middle-class used to mean, it meant Jim Anderson, and Father Knows the Best. He came home every night. That was the middle-class. And at the other end, it meant Chester A. Riley and The Life of Riley. But boy.
What about Willie Loman and Death of a Salesman? That's a long time ago and a lot of angst right there.
That's certainly true, and I think that's more and more the picture here, the picture of the salesperson, of someone who's out there on a shoeshine trying with personality to hold on to any rung you can grasp.
Shoeshine and a smile. Barbara Ehrenreich is bringing it home to us in her new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is the White Collar High Wire Act and its casualty toll ignored in America? It was bad for Willie Loman in Death of the Salesman. Is it really worse today? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barbara Ehrenreich, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the white-collar blues with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of the new book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. You can join us. What's been your experience of walking out to look for a white-collar job? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Nancy's calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know?
I had a very, very good job in the early 90s. I was the president of a mortgage company. I have my master's degree in finance from Rice University and, you know, was really doing well.
Yeah.
I had three kids in 3 years and quit my job because it was a high-powered job and it was almost impossible to do both of those jobs at the same time for
okay.
me.
Okay.
And then I tried to get back into the workforce a couple years later when the kids had grown up a little bit and put on the suit and did the interviewing, had the resume, and just couldn't get anywhere with it. Spent about 3 years looking for a job.
3 years.
And then I started to bring my expectations down as I was going through the process. Very demoralizing process, very difficult process. And what I ended up doing after spending a lot of time trying to re-enter the workforce was I basically had to reinvent myself, and I started my own internet company out of my home. Been doing that now for about 4 years. It's very successful, and it ended up working out well for me because my kids are in high school and middle school now, and I can keep very flexible hours.
Nancy, let me ask you a few things. First of all, internet company sounds mysterious to people these days after everything we've been through. What, can you give us any idea? How do you make money? How do you make money on the internet?
I buy silver jewelry beads wholesale, and I sell them.
On eBay?
I turn around and sell them. On eBay, and I have my own website. And
got it. So you're one of those many kind of eBay traders who's made a life out of it. And what lesson have you taken away from this? Is it that the system doesn't work, or that you just had to adapt and get really creative, or both?
Both. The system, I dropped out of the system voluntarily, and I couldn't get back in. And I wonder to this day where I'd be if I hadn't dropped out. But it's a very, very difficult system to get back into, and you do end up having to be creative because when you start dropping your expectations after you've gone on many interviews and you still can't get what you're looking for, you have to start thinking to yourself, what am I going to do?
Absolutely, and we hear what you did, Nancy, and we're glad it worked for you. Barbara Ehrenreich, what do you make of this story? Here, Nancy was the head of a mortgage company. She has a master's in finance. She would sound very employable. Didn't work for her, but then there's a kind of American way aspect to this story, too. She turned around, started her own company, and it's working.
Yeah, the thing I wanted to pick up on, though, is that, you know, a lot of women now are doing this. They're very high-powered women, young professionals. We read, anyway, articles all the time about them saying, I'm going to take a few years off while the kids are small, and then I'll leap back in. Well, I wonder how easy that is for anybody, not just Nancy, because I try, you know, when I was within these various job search situations, I remember asking a coach at one point, what if I have a gap in my resume due to homemaking?
Mm-hmm.
And or raising children, which would be a true part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something like, you have to have a pretty good story to explain that. What? I need
perpetuation
a story to explain
of the human race?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, a lot, you can't have a gap. Which is terrible because, of course, we do have children, and men as well as women sometimes take off years to be with them.
Let me ask you, if I may, that what is your sense of what makes the difference between those who go for 3 years or 4 years, as we've heard from callers this morning, without that job, and those who get hired again? Because, of course, many people do find new jobs. You describe people having 6 or 7 or 8 or more employers in a lifetime. That means they are getting hired again, and many of them in the white-collar world. What makes the difference?
I don't know, but I wouldn't blame the person, him or herself. And often those jobs are of diminishing quality. On average, people's pay, when people get rehired, reemployed, they're going to be earning about 70% of what they were earning before. So you do that a few times and you're down pretty low. You know, it may be a downward spiral.
It may.
But I think Nancy is inspirational in that she, you know, became an entrepreneur. A lot of people dream of doing such a thing. The problem is that small businesses are themselves very insecure. Maybe not in your case, Nancy, but something like, 50% of them fail within 4 years.
And of course, trading silver beads on eBay does not come with health insurance or a retirement package, that's for sure. Let's get another call. John is calling from Boston. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. What do you know?
Well, a lot of people have made some of the points that I would have made as well. Chris in Medford sounds a lot like me. I'm just a little bit older. What comes to mind as I listen more is the issue of creativity, really what it does to your self-esteem. In my case, I like to think that I'm resourceful and creative. I've got get up and go. I've got ideas.
Are you looking for a job? Have you been?
I have been looking for a job for quite some time. I was in the telecommunications industry and all manner of it for quite a while in the 90s, and went off to work on a startup business, which I have no regrets over doing, but that didn't yield anything. And so for the last couple of years, I've been billing myself as a consultant with, truth be known, really no clientele.
And yeah, that is not unheard of. And are you? What about your confidence at this point that you will live the rest of your life in the middle class, John?
I have no choice but to be optimistic. I'm too young to throw things in, absolutely. But the nature of expectations, the idea that people say to you, well, don't be so picky, or start over, or take anything. And you ask yourself, well, what does it mean to take anything? I've actually had interviews that are for what I would think are take anything jobs. And I'm told over and over again, well, gee, you're overqualified, or gee, you have too much of a business perspective.
Chris didn't want to move. She didn't want to leave her home city. What about you? Are you willing to go wherever the jobs are?
I could just about anywhere.
And still, it hasn't happened yet. Well, we wish you luck, John. Barbara Ehrenreich, here's another consultant, and quite candidly, without many or any clients, that everybody's a consultant in the tier you in the world you were living
yes.
in.
Yes. Yes, I think a consultant is defined as somebody who stays home and occasionally gives his brother-in-law advice on how to use a computer or something.
Right. But let me ask you, if I may, what we've just got a couple minutes. What is it that you want here? Do you want to go out and be assigned to work unit 48637? What do you want?
What do I want? I want to see people who are in this situation, in this terrible limbo, first of all, not blame themselves. You know, get over any of that. It's not you, your personality, your looks, your age. And start looking at what are some concrete things in the world that we could do that would, at least ameliorate the situation a little bit. We should have universal health insurance. That is a no-brainer. You know, maybe it made
sense
to...
Whether you're employed or not, right.
Yeah, maybe it made sense to attach health insurance to jobs when people had 2-3 jobs in their whole lifetimes. But no longer. It's completely ridiculous. And that's a very big factor. We also need more generous and extensive unemployment compensation. It runs out now after 6 months. 6 months is about the average length of a white-collar job search. So there are an awful lot of people, you know, where it runs out and it won't do. I do think we also need to look at these layoffs and where they're coming from, because so many government subsidies and tax breaks to corporations are justified on the basis of the fact that supposedly corporations generate jobs. So we now have, at this moment, Hewlett-Packard getting a huge tax break amounting to, I think it's about $8 billion, while they lay off 14,500 folks.
So where's the justification there, you ask?
Well, yeah, and there, this tax break comes under the so-called American Jobs Creation Bill of 2005.
And off it goes right abroad in no small part. You say, look beyond your own circumstances. Look at the big picture here. Jack Beatty, I can imagine you seconding that.
Yes, it's a new world. Peter Drucker says corporations built to last like pyramids are now more like tents. Well, if the corporations are like tents, well, think what it's like for the employees. Well,
strike the tent, find a hole to get into. Barbara Ehrenreich, it was fun following your journey in Bait and Switch. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Oh, pleasure talking to you.
And Jack Beatty, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining
us. Thank
you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, how one National Guardsman back from Iraq is taking Nashville by storm. This is On Point. ...22-year-old soldier Luke Strickland spent a year in Iraq. For months, friends and family of the Arkansas National Guardsman asked what it was like and wanted him to share his feelings about the war. He couldn't. Conversations over a static-filled phone line were not enough. So he paid a young Iraqi boy $25 to help him find a guitar. When he got it, Strickland wrote a song. He called it American by God's Amazing Grace. He and his Army buddy, J.R. Schultz, hunkered down in their Baghdad camp. With a laptop, a cheap microphone, and some free software, they recorded the song and emailed it home. Nashville heard about it. By the time Strickland returned to the U.S., the song was on country radio stations across the country. Now, the Iraqi vet has a self-titled album due out in September. We recently caught up with Luke Strickland and his guitar and asked him to tell us more about the experiences that inspired American by God's Amazing Grace.
Hi, this is Luke Strickland, and I'm here with Lyle Parman, my lead guitar player, and we're fixing to play my new single, American by God's Amazing Grace. 1, 2, 3, 4.
The bottom of my boots sure are getting worn, and there's a lot of holes in this faded uniform. My hands are black with dirt, and so is my face. I ain't ever been to hell, but it couldn't be any worse than this place.
Well, the starting line of the song is, the bottom of my boots sure are getting worn. And that's exactly what I said in my head. I thought, that's the line right there. And I had a green notebook that pretty much every soldier's got one. I scratched down, about the first verse and chorus on that notebook. And I recorded it, and it was ready to be emailed home.
I tell my wife, don't work, sign what to do. It makes her feel better sometimes, but I don't know if it's true. I know if I die, well, it's just my time to go. But I pray to God every day that I make it back home.
Started out answering a question, you know, of what's it like in Iraq. And sitting on the phone and having a conversation with a loved one 7,000 miles away and listening to him cry is kind of, that's a pain that not many people have felt. So this song was a way for me to answer that question without having to be there and have the initial blow of seeing your loved ones upset.
Well, when you've seen what I've seen, things don't seem so bad. You quit worrying about what you ain't got and thank God for what you had. Because I couldn't be raising my family in this place, but I was born an American by God's amazing grace. Last 12 months I've had a new address. The neighborhood smelled like sewage and the streets were lime trash. You never know what's gonna be the next thing to explode. But unlike these people, I have another home. It breaks my heart to see these kids out on the streets, walking barefoot through the trash, begging for something to eat. I give them what I got just to let them know I care. And I thank God it's not my son that's standing there.
I talk about the Iraqi people and the state that they live in to give an example of why it's such a blessing to be an American and be born in America or to live in America. You know, I've seen a lot of death and destruction, but what bothered me most is, actually it rained about maybe 5 days throughout the whole 12 months I was in Baghdad, yet there were streets that had water standing on for 12 months, and obviously it's sewer water. And, you know, see some of those kids, you know, a 3-year-old toddler tracking through that ankle deep sewer water, you know, that's a tough sight for somebody like me.
Talk about it, you better keep it short, 'cause I've got a lot of lost time that I gotta make up for. I really don't care why Bush went into Iraq. I know what I done there, and I'm damn sure proud of that.
What that line says, I don't care why Bush went into Iraq, a lot of people have commented on that. A lot of people complain about him going over there, and as the soldier, it's kind of like, you know, I myself and a lot of my other fellow soldiers spending time in Iraq, we get tired of hearing people argue about it. You know, people are sitting at home and it's not affecting them directly, and then here we are sitting in Iraq, and it kind of like, why do you have the right to complain so much? There's no need in arguing in it. You know, if he issues the order, and that's something we have to abide by.
You got something bad to say about the USA, better save it for different ears, lest you want to crawl away. And I'll laugh in your face if you say you've got it in bed, until you spend some time on the streets of Baghdad.
Well, I tell you, I had no idea when JR and I wrote this song that it would spark such an interest, you know, in the public back here in the States. This whole thing has been pretty exciting. I mean, I was in Iraq 4 or 5 months ago, and then I was on the Grand Ole Opry 2 weeks ago, so it's been crazy.
Well, when you've seen what I've seen, things don't seem so bad. You quit worrying about what you ain't got, thank God for what you had. Because you couldn't be raising your family in this place, but you were born an American by God's amazing grace.
Luke Strickland lives in Rudy, Arkansas. Read more about him and his debut album at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.